Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You are going to hear a lot this fall about the Keystone XL pipeline, a 1,700-mile giant proposed to stretch from Canada's vast tar sands in Alberta across Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas to the Gulf of Mexico. Washington is hearing a lot about it already. 1,200 and more people have been arrested there in just the last couple of weeks protesting the pipeline in front of the White House. A decision is coming. There is a lot on the line. This hour on Point, the Keystone XL pipeline and America at an energy crossroads. You can join the conversation. What do you say? Build it? Don't build it? Should we pipe the tar sands oil of Canada across America to your car and the world? Is this our energy future, our energy past? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We're going to hear today from strong proponents and opponents of the pipeline. A couple of voices right here. This was a meeting of the Construction and General Laborers Local 1140 in Lincoln, Nebraska, this past February. Union members looking for jobs. Jo Adkins says she supports the Keystone Pipeline.
I like the idea that we will be getting our resources from our neighbors. And then it's going to obviously create jobs. And being a single mother, I have to provide the only income into our home. And so that would be ideal for somebody like me. And I'm sure I'm not the only one out there.
Jo Adkins in Nebraska, she'd like the work. Not everybody in Nebraska is so hot on it. We'll hear from a rancher who says no thanks. But here's environmentalist, author, and journalist Bill McKibben in front of the White House. This was just last month. There were a couple of weeks of big protests there, many, many arrests, including McKibben himself, warning about the environmental impact of the pipeline. Here was taking part in a protest against the Keystone XL pipeline moments before he was himself arrested.
That pipeline up there in northern Canada is the second largest pool of carbon on Earth. Our most important climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA, Jim Hansen said not long ago, if we burn large quantities of that oil, it is, and I quote, essentially game over for the climate.
Game over for the climate. Don't build the pipeline. Leave those tar sands where they are. Don't release that carbon. Joining me first today from New York is Michael Levy, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and director of the Council's Program on Energy Security and Climate Change. Michael Levy, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Council on Foreign Relations and the State Department in Washington involved in this because this is an international pipeline, so it needs approval at that international level, I guess, Michael.
Right. This is an issue that meets with a variety of important foreign policy challenges. Energy, economics, security, and climate change. That's why I look at it here. Council on Foreign Relations is obviously a non-governmental, non-profit institution, and it's why the State Department is looking at it, because it is very much a foreign policy issue.
Where do we stand in the approval process at this point? What are the green lights already? What's the ultimate sign-off that's needed, or that perhaps they won't get on this pipeline? Where do we stand?
I'd say there's a very faint green light, but not a full one yet. This is a long process where the State Department has to look at a variety of different elements. The most extended part of that process has been an environmental impact statement that has been under development for a long time, was finally released in the last couple weeks, which essentially concludes that the environmental impacts to the United States are manageable and are marginal at most. That a lot of people have interpreted, I think correctly, as setting the stage for a decision that would let this go ahead. But ultimately, the State Department, and if necessary, the president, has to make a decision on more broad grounds as to whether this is in the national interest or not before it can go ahead.
So it's in the hands of the Obama administration. Is there a deadline for a thumbs up or thumbs down, Michael?
There's no deadline, but the administration has telegraphed that this decision is coming by the end of the year. This has already been an unusually long process for permitting a pipeline, and at some point you run into problems if you're concerned about being able to move supply into the markets where it's used already. There are some constraints that appear to be developing. So the administration, I think, would like to move ahead. At the same time, they don't want to cut corners on the environmental impact assessments, both because it's important to protect the environment, but also because you don't want to expose the process to lawsuits and challenges after it's all done.
Can you describe this thing physically? 1,700 miles from Alberta, all the way down, snaking across the Great Plains to Houston and to Port Arthur there on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico and Texas. But what is this pipe? Is it above ground, below ground? I'm reading it's just a half inch thick. Is it thinner than normal? 36-inch diameter, is that correct? How much oil would this carry?
You've done a nice job of describing it. It would carry somewhere between, and the numbers aren't entirely clear, 500,000 and 1 million barrels per day of what we call dilbit, diluted bitumen. So what you get when you produce oil up in Alberta in this unconventional oil, this oil sands or tar sands, is something called bitumen. It isn't actually oil,
right,
but it can be processed to extract oil, which is then refined into things like gasoline and diesel and jet fuel that people actually use. In order to get it moving in the pipe, you combine this bitumen with traditional oil, and that lets it flow through.
Why do people
so
want?
What would be?
Why do they want to get it to this location, Houston, Port Arthur? Why there?
We've got a lot of refineries down there that are either are underutilized or have the potential to be underutilized. These are refineries that are particularly suited to processing the kind of oil that comes out of Alberta. This oil, this material, is similar to what comes from Venezuela, and a lot of those refineries were built to handle Venezuelan crude, which is at lower levels than it was in the past. So this is about, at some level, matching existing refineries with the oil that's coming out of the ground.
The pipeline itself.
Right now, mm-hmm. The oil coming out of Alberta is piling up in Cushing, Oklahoma, which is where the pipeline's currently lead, and that's why oil in Cushing is actually extremely cheap right now, because there's this glut.
And they can't get it to the port. They can't get it out to the rest of the world. This pipeline itself, above ground, below ground, both, and is it thinner skin than most or not?
That, frankly, I'll have to ask probably one of your later guests,
okay,
Susan or Alex, will be able to tell you. There have been a lot of back and forth discussions on how far below ground the pipeline has to be buried in particular places, the various safeguards. Things have been modified through the course of the environmental impact assessment that the State Department has conducted.
And the game over prognosis that we heard Bill McKibben talking about there from Jim Hansen, who was a climatologist with NASA. What's that about? That's because it's so energy intensive to get this out of the ground up in Canada, unleash this kind of very dirty process?
Jim Hansen makes this argument that there's so much in the ground in Canada that if you extract all of it, it would add so much burden to the atmosphere that it would be game over for climate change. At a very narrow technical level, that might be correct. What he doesn't mention is that at current rates of extraction, it would take about 3,000 years to pull that all out of the ground. And even if things were ramped up to where people see them being ramped up to higher production levels, it would still take 1,000 years. So whether or not that is extracted is not going to be determined by this pipeline.
Whether or not it's all extracted.
If we're sitting around 900 years from now wondering whether we're going to take out the last drops, we've already failed on climate change. So I personally, when I look at the numbers, don't come to this game over conclusion.
And yet there's big pressure on this. How much oil, new oil or energy would this put into the American system? Or is that even an appropriate question? I mean, energy is global. It's fungible. Would this provide half of our needs, 2%? What?
Well, energy, you're correct, energy is global. When we talk about 1 million barrels per day, that's about 5% of U.S. consumption or about 1% of global consumption. The best way to think about it is that it has an impact on global prices. More supply coming into the market holds down global prices, and that, everything else being equal, is good for the U.S. economy. Obviously, more supply coming into the system also raises global greenhouse gas emissions, which is bad for climate change, and that's why you have, that's one of the big reasons why you have this trade-off here. A lot of people do think about this as somehow benefiting the United States because it adds a reliable direct supply. I personally tend to look at oil more as a global system and put less emphasis on that physical side of the equation, but that's how some people will look at it.
$7 billion to be invested in a pipeline system if it gets a green light here. Would we be better off putting that into alternative energies? Where do you come down on this one, Michael? Are you thumbs up or thumbs down on Keystone XL?
I lean toward it. I'm fairly ambivalent in a lot of ways because I don't think it's the end of the world one way or the other. I think there's a false trade-off if you talk about putting this into alternative energy versus into this pipeline. The investors in this pipeline aren't going to suddenly start spending on alternative energy. The difference between doing that and not doing that is policy. And that's a totally separate set of policy questions. So I don't see why there is as hard of a trade-off as some people would claim. I think we need to be doing a lot more on climate change. We need to be doing a lot more to reduce oil consumption. And if we succeed in that, we'll eventually bring prices down to a level where the oil sands are uneconomic. But for right now, given where prices are, given where demand is, I see there being non-trivial economic benefits to moving forward with this. But again, we need to, if we care about climate change, be doing a lot more on the demand side of things.
And certainly you've heard that very loud cry from the streets in front of the White House just in the last couple of weeks. I mean, the protests are very vivid against this.
Well, there are a lot of people who are very passionate about this. I think for a couple of reasons. Some of them genuinely believe this game over rhetoric, which I think grossly exaggerates the situation. But others, I think, to be fair, see this as a symbolic decision. And they see this as signaling the overall attitude of this administration to climate change issues. I personally think that you can be serious about climate change and also be supportive of the pipeline. But I understand that a lot of these protesters don't see it that way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the big debate over a big energy pipeline from Canada's tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico, the Keystone XL pipeline that would cut across the Great Plains, six American states, 1,700 miles, and approval is very likely coming or not coming by the end of this year. Michael Levy has joined us from the Council on Foreign Relations. He's following it there closely in their program on energy security and climate change. The promise is energy from right next door and lots of jobs. Here's Nebraska AFL-CIO President Ken Mass in Lincoln, Nebraska last February, throwing his union's weight behind the Keystone Project.
The pipeline would create thousands of jobs. Thousands of jobs that will create, help these folks out and the building trades, but also help the economy out and help the revenue in the state of Nebraska.
But here's Jane Klebe, the head of a progressive Nebraska political organization called Bold Nebraska, at the Washington protests last month, saying running a pipeline over the Ogallala Aquifer, which would be under miles and miles of this pipeline, is an environmental disaster waiting to happen.
The Ogallala Aquifer is this huge, large body of water that essentially sits under the entire state of Nebraska. And it provides not only our clean drinking water, but provides all the water for our agriculture, which is our main source of income for our state. And so this pipeline literally cuts through the Ogallala Aquifer right in the heart of it. And it potentially could contaminate our drinking water and our economic activity.
She's not the only one worried about that. Here on August 5th, members of her group outside Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman's mansion in Lincoln. No pipeline, but it may well be coming. Joining us now from Washington, Susan Casey Lefkowitz, Director of the International Program at the National Resources Defense Council. She's been closely following the Keystone XL pipeline. We'll hear in just a moment from a representative of the company who wants to get it built. But Susan Casey Lefkowitz, first to you. Thanks for joining us. What's your case against this pipeline?
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, when you look across the United States and even across Canada, we're all feeling the impacts of climate change right now. We've seen droughts across the Southeast, and lately we've all been watching with horror as the fires have been spreading in Texas.
There have
been violent storms and flooding. And what it really comes down to is we can't afford to deepen our dependence on oil by going after dirtier sources such as tar sands. And this particular pipeline is a major decision point for the United States. It would more than double our dependence on tar sands, exactly at a time when we actually are starting to move towards cleaner forms of energy, cleaner transportation solutions. You know, the good news is we don't need this pipeline, and we don't need to be supporting expansion of tar sands.
Who says we don't need it? We consume a lot of oil in this country, and that may or may not be a good thing, but we sure use a lot of it.
We do, but you know what we're seeing happening right now is we're actually reducing our use of oil in the United States, and we have the mechanisms and the ability right now to reduce it even further. Just over the next few years, our calculations show we can bring our oil use down by 4 million barrels per day. That's a lot of oil.
What about the argument that if you don't build this, that it'll get out some other way? It'll go out by truck or rail or alternative pipeline over the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Coast and straight to China?
You know, there's a lot of proposals out there for how to move tar sands to markets, but the fact is right now the U.S. is the main market for tar sands oil. And ironically, this pipeline, this Keystone XL pipeline, which is being proposed for, you know, American energy security, that's what proponents say, it's going to be an American supply of oil, it gives tar sands its first deep water port from which it could go anywhere in the world. There is no guarantee that the oil companies, once they get it to the refineries in the Gulf, aren't going to send it to Europe and to China, whereas the pipelines that have been proposed to the East Coast and the West Coast of Canada are facing very fierce opposition that can't be underestimated. Right now, we don't anticipate seeing tar sands oil being able to reach a coast in Canada to go elsewhere in the world anytime soon.
You cover this, follow it for the Natural Resources Defense Council. You must be following the politics very closely. You heard Michael Levy say the State Department already gave it a kind of soft green light, saying there would not be significant overall environmental threat to the United States. We'll hear another view on that. But how do you reckon the odds right now of this getting a green light from the Obama White House?
Yeah, the State Department was completely wrong when they said that there would be no significant impacts. And in fact, we feel as though they've been rushing the environmental review process through without doing the kind of in-depth and objective studies that they have been promising us they would do. They've neglected to take a really hard expert look at the pipeline safety issues. You heard earlier Jane Klebe from Nebraska talking about the dangers to the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the main source of fresh water for many states in America's heartland. They've neglected to take a hard look at environmental justice issues around the refineries and the kind of pollution that could come from the refineries. And they haven't looked at an alternate path that the pipeline could take instead of going through the Ogallala Aquifer and the Nebraska Sandhills. In fact, just over the last few days, the Nebraska governor, Governor Heineman, and Senator Johanns from Nebraska have both come out and said this pipeline should not go through Nebraska.
You say they're wrong, but your political analysis right now, how do you see this leaning? How do you see the Obama administration leaning for or against construction?
Well, I think that the State Department, the people who have been moving the process forward, they found no significant impact. But there's a lot more that still has to happen before we have a final decision. I think that the protests and the sit-ins in front of the White House have changed the political feeling about this pipeline. It's become clear that the pipeline in tar sands is not something that should be part of a clean energy future for America. And there's many more months of, as Michael mentioned, looking at whether this pipeline is really in the national interest. And that's what the decision is going to come down to. So I think it's too early to tell which way the administration will go.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz with the Natural Resources Defense Council and Michael Levy with the Council on Foreign Relations there in New York. Please stand by. I want to go now to Alberta in Western Canada, to Calgary, to Alex Pourbaix. He's president of Energy and Oil Pipelines and the number two man at TransCanada. That is the Canadian energy company that hopes to build the Keystone XL pipeline. Alex Pourbaix, thank you very much for being with us.
No problem. Glad to be here, Tom.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz says, no way, no thank you, we don't want it. You have made the case over and over that it should be built. Let's hear it. What's the case, Alex?
Well, Tom, I think ultimately the opponents of Keystone will have you believe that this is an environmental disaster. I think actually the issues that the American public need to consider are really not about the environmental impact. The issues are about energy security and jobs. And as Michael said earlier, the U.S. consumes around 15 million barrels of oil a day and produces around 4 or 5 million barrels of oil a day. And I think under any reasonable assessment, the U.S. will remain dependent on imported oil for decades. And in fact, that is the finding of this administration. The Department of Energy has stated that repeatedly. You know, so if we're all of the view that the U.S. is going to remain reliant on imported oil, the real question remains, where do you want to get our oil from? Canada has the third largest reserves of oil on the planet, 175 billion barrels. That puts us just behind Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And I think Americans have a choice. They can source our oil from Canada, their greatest ally and largest trading partner, or they can obtain their oil from Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Nigeria, Libya, Iran, Iraq. Unlike many of these countries, Canada has comprehensive and transparent environmental legislation. We're a leader globally in human rights, and we have committed to the exact same greenhouse gas reduction targets as the U.S. And I'd end off by saying that Keystone XL represents, I think by almost any measure, the single largest private sector stimulus opportunity available today to the U.S. economy. And just to put that in perspective, within days of receiving our presidential permit, we will begin to put 20,000 Americans to work building this pipeline. In addition, there's going to be in excess of 100,000 spin-off jobs created by this massive infrastructure project. You know, this is a project that is shovel-ready and will inject $20 billion into the U.S. economy without one penny of government subsidy.
Well, look at the jobs. You're pointing there at Canada's enormous resources here, but they are dirty resources, particularly dirty in the production. It's really a complicated energy-intensive process to get this out of the ground. If that 135 billion barrels come out of the ground, even a significant portion of them, Alex Purvey, is that game over for the climate?
The hyperbole around this environmental issue is getting fairly extreme. So indulge me, and I'll put a little facts on the table with respect to the greenhouse gas intensity of oil sands production.
But if I may, you already put one on the table, 135 billion, if I got your number right. I mean, that's a point of pride that you'd like to unleash. So that's what we're talking about here. So I don't know if it's hyperbole.
Wait a second. As Michael talked about, it will take hundreds of years for those barrels to get out. We're talking about adding a pipeline that's going to add about 700,000, 800,000 barrels of oil a day to the U.S. economy. And, you know, just recently in the context of this presidential permit and the environmental review, CERA, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, came out with a study where they looked at all of the scientific work that had been done on the greenhouse gas intensity of the oil sands, and they came to the conclusion that the average barrel of oil sands oil imported into the U.S. has about 6% higher carbon intensity than the average barrel of oil consumed in the U.S. today.
Does that include the production of that oil?
That includes everything.
All the natural gas burned to get it out of the ground and get it
absolutely
in a movable state?
One of the things you need to remember is right now, those refineries in the U.S. Gulf Coast, which are where the oil from the Keystone pipeline is going, are already burning or processing heavy crude. If Canadian oil is prevented from crossing the border and getting to those refineries, those refineries are going to continue to source heavy crude from farther away. There is going to be unnecessary tanker traffic, which has very significant greenhouse gas emissions, and net-net, as the State Department determined in their environmental impact statement, they did not believe at the end of the day there would be any material difference in greenhouse gas production as a result of going ahead with Keystone XL.
Alex Purvey, what about the argument Philip Verliger makes it? He's up at the University of Calgary, just in your backyard there, that the refineries on the Gulf Coast are all tied up in contracts with Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Mexico, that this tar sands oil is not going to end up in this country. It's going to go down there and be shipped off to China and end up being, you know, bought and used in China.
You know, Phil has a very interesting theory on this. I worry that it isn't very grounded in facts. As I said before, right now the U.S. is the largest consumer of crude oil on the planet, 15 million barrels a day. They're importing 10 million barrels a day every day. Canadian crude oil right now is the cheapest source of crude oil on the planet. It is anywhere from $30 to $50 cheaper than sea-based crude. It would be almost nonsensical for refiners who are looking to maximize their margins to take that oil, export it offshore when they have such a significant need for refined products in the country that isn't being served by the domestic production. So I you know, it's an interesting theory, but I don't think it bears up to hard scrutiny.
Do you think you're going to get a green light?
I think that, you know, we have been through an exhaustive process on the environmental side of this project, culminating in this final environmental impact statement, which found no material environmental issues. We're now moving into the national interest determination, where the State Department is going to look at the economic, the benefits, the taxes, the jobs, the impact on the U.S. economy, and we're very confident when they go through that work, they're going to give a green light to the project.
Susan Casey-Lefkowitz, you hear the argument. It's hyperbole, says Alex Perbe, on the environmental damage front. There are a lot of jobs here. The U.S. needs stimulus. The shovel ready, 20,000, 100,000 indirectly, and off we go. What do you say, Susan?
Well, our findings are that the jobs estimates are wildly exaggerated, but you know, even though these are short-term jobs are jobs. They're important. But what we think is that you can do a lot better for the economy and for jobs with clean energy jobs. Those are the longer-term ones that are really stay-in-America jobs. And it's, you know, it's interesting. The prices issue of gas also keeps coming up. I mean, basically, oil is determined in a global market. It's the prices are determined globally. The fact that the tar sands is cheaper, I think, is benefiting the oil companies, not the American public and not the Canadian public. I mean, the Canadians are mostly using tar sands at this point, and their gas prices are just as high as ours are here south of the border. And in fact, one interesting thing about this pipeline is that because it would, for the first decade or so, mostly be relieving the glut of oil, as Michael described, up in the Midwest, Midwest oil prices and gas prices would actually go up because of this pipeline. One thing that
Susan, if I may, let me bring a listener in on right around this point.
Of course.
You just a second. We've got a lot lined up here. Jeff in Boston, thanks for calling. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right. What's your question?
Just a quick question. If this pipeline does, in fact, go into operation, does it affect U.S. consumer gas prices? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Gas prices at the pump. Michael Levy, let me bring that one to you. If build it and it starts flowing, do we have lower gasoline prices on the basis of that flow or not?
You would expect slightly lower gasoline prices. In the long term, it's hard to see how they would be much lower. In the medium term, it's much more difficult to project. But look, the bottom line is that if putting the pipeline in place allows Canadian oil to be produced and you have more oil on the world market, that lowers world oil prices. Again, not necessarily by much, but it lowers world oil prices. It doesn't mean that the United States has cheaper oil than Canada or than Europe. That's the wrong way to think about it. But more supply available generally means lower oil prices and hence lower gasoline prices. Susan is correct that because of the intricacies of how the pipeline system works, you would see higher oil prices in the Midwest and slightly lower world oil prices. I don't think you would see a difference in gasoline prices between different parts of the country, just like you don't see significant differences right now.
Susan, Americans are desperate for lower gasoline prices. What do you say to our caller? You get the import of his question. Would it make his gas cheaper?
Yeah, I don't think that it would make the gas cheaper. And I think that one thing that Michael is perhaps overlooking in his comment is that world oil prices in part are also set by OPEC, because they're still one of the most powerful segments in terms of the oil market. And when more production comes from somewhere else in the world, they tend to limit their production. And so you don't actually see gas prices going down in the U.S. because of an increase of supply from Canada.
We've got a lot more.
Mind if I come back in?
Alex, please, just for 20 seconds, we've got a break coming up. What do you say?
Sorry, that was Michael.
Oh, I'm sorry. Michael, please, Michael, yes.
You can't have it both ways. If adding the Canadian supply to the market increases greenhouse gas emissions, it also increases world oil supply and decreases prices. If you think OPEC will cut back to keep prices steady, that also means you think it will keep back and limit the greenhouse gas emissions. You have to pick one or the other.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big debate over a big energy pipeline from Canada's tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico, the Keystone XL pipeline that would cut across the Great Plains, six American states, 1,700 miles to deliver that heavy, heavy Canada tar sands oil or bitumen product all the way down to Houston and Port Arthur on the Gulf of Mexico. Alex Pourbaix is with us. He's with TransCanada, the company that wants to build it, joins us from Calgary, Canada. Susan Casey-Lefkowitz is with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council. She was among others, 1,200-plus, who were arrested in Washington over the last couple of weeks in protest against building this pipeline. Michael Levy is with us from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. You've heard him trying to balance this. We've got listeners saying, get busy and build it. We've got others saying, no thanks. Neil writes, tar sands are like an alcoholic going into an old bar to suck the carpet to get the spilled booze. I guess he's not for it. I want to talk right now, Alex, Susan, Michael, if you can stand by, to a rancher in Nebraska who's not so hot on this project. Randy Thompson joins us. He's become a kind of a local opposition hero among those opposed to the pipeline. His family owns 400 acres in Merritt County, and the proposed pipeline would cut across 80 acres of his family's land. Randy Thompson joins us from Martell, Nebraska. Randy, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You're against the pipeline, at least on your land. Why?
Well, as any other citizen, I think, would feel, if someone wanted to put a massive pipeline directly into your water supply, pumping 700,000 to 900,000 barrels of some kind of toxic solution through your water supply every day, I think anyone would be concerned about that.
Explain, we've heard some about the Ogallala, but explain exactly the sort of physical relationship that would be there, Randy, between the pipeline and water supply. What do you mean by running through it?
Well, on our property, our water table is very high. If I go out and dig a post hole 3 to 4 feet deep, I will have water come into that post hole. So when they're talking about burying this pipe 4 feet in the ground, it's going to be sitting directly in the water. And this is very much the case throughout the Sandhills. And we have a very porous sandy soil, which is a big concern with, you know, with the water where it's at.
And then people talk about the Ogallala Aquifer, which underwrites a huge portion of American agriculture. Is that related to the Sandhills water you're talking about? Is that also a problem?
Absolutely. It is the aquifer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have talked about rerouting this thing. And the area in eastern Nebraska, you would have a separation between the pipeline and the water supply of roughly 100 to 200 feet of hard clay dirt. In the Sandhills, there is not that separation. The pipe and the water table would be commingled, which to me would be a potential for a disaster.
Have you looked into this? I mean, what if some oil, oil spills can be small or they can be large or they can be in between? What size of spill would it take to cause a serious problem?
Well, it would probably take several thousand gallons to do serious harm. But, I kind of have to laugh when the company talks about it's all going to be localized. Well, what is a localized leak? Is that just on my place, or does that affect three or four of the surrounding communities? How big of a leak, how big of a plume of oil is considered to be a localized leak? Are you going to take out the water supply for one ranch or several ranches or maybe a few small communities? So, what do they really mean by a localized leak?
And what about the support there among your political representatives? Are they with you or against you on this, Randy, in Nebraska?
Well, I would say that we have some of both. I think more of our state legislators have become more aware of the potential harm it could do to our state and in recent months. And we have had some of our national representatives that very much, like Senator Johans, has definitely said that the route is the worst route that they could have selected for this pipeline.
And does it break down Republican and Democrat, or do you have opposition support on both sides?
The support has been on both sides of the aisle, because Senator Ben Nelson has also made pretty much the same statement, that he feels that the route, definitely is not the right place for this pipeline.
We've got callers from your neck of the woods, Randy Thompson. If you could stand by. Mary Ann's calling from Bellevue, Nebraska. Mary Ann, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just outraged by the whole concept of a half-an-inch pipe going across the aquifer. I do not trust anything that oil companies say to you. I don't think they've repaired the damage they did in the Gulf, Alaska. There was an oil spill up in Yellowstone. I do not trust them to put a half-inch pipe anywhere through the state that, and then say, oh, a minimal damage we can control. There should be no damage contemplated. It's just unconscionable to me.
I don't trust
anything they say.
Marianne, we've got it. I guess you can't really have a pipeline without the possibility of damage. But Alex Perbet, what about this concern? Randy Thompson's got it right on his farm. Marianne raises the thickness of the pipeline. I from what I'm reading, it's thinner than your typical pipeline. Why is that? What about these safety issues over this big, important water supply, Alex?
First off, this is not thin wall pipe. This is a state-of-the-art pipe. It is the highest strength steel that you would regularly see in any pipeline of this type. And let me just say, TransCanada has a 60-year record of building and operating pipelines safely. We would never have proposed a pipeline that if we were not completely confident that we would be able to operate that pipeline safely.
But no pipeline can guarantee that there'll never be a spill. You know that as well as everybody knows
Agreed, but what we know even more directly is that pipelines are by far the safest method by orders of magnitude over any of the other methods of transporting oil.
You mean rail or truck or
ship? I mean, this pipeline alone is going to replace 200 tanker transits a year of super tankers into those Gulf Coast refineries, and that is a much, much riskier thing to do. And I just want to address, I think there's a lot of misconception about aquifers in general and the Ogallala in particular. Aquifers are not giant underground pools of water. They're water-saturated soils, clays, and sand. And water moves through them very, very slowly, and there has been an extraordinary amount of scientific work done on the movement of oil through aquifers. The State Department, in the environmental impact statement, after exhaustively reviewing this, came to the conclusion that there was no elevated risk of significant contamination of the aquifer as a result of Keystone XL. And just one other comment I'd like to make. You know, the aquifer does not just underlie Nebraska. The Great Plains Aquifer, which it is connected to, underlies massive parts of many states, including Texas and Oklahoma. We have tens of thousands of miles of crude oil pipelines and oil wells produce and transport oil, millions of barrels of oil every day across and through this aquifer, and have done so for decades.
Why not build around, as Randy Thompson says? Why not get where there's more distance between the pipeline and the water?
You know, as a pipeline developer, it is one of our core obligations to absolutely, wherever possible, minimize the environmental impact of our route. And we looked, and if you take a look at the Department of State's environmental impact statement, there were 8 routes considered, including routes that would have avoided the Sand Hills. Every time you move the pipeline to avoid one special area, you have a tendency to run into other special areas, other aquifers, other special places. And at the end of the day, the State Department looked at the risks of going through the sand hills and came to the conclusion that that was a lower risk than routing around it with the attendant environmental impacts of building a longer pipeline through different terrain.
Let's get another call from Randy Thompson territory, at least in Nebraska. Tim in Omaha. Thanks for calling, Tim. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. My question is that we're running this pipeline, or talking about running this pipeline, down to the refineries along the Gulf Coast, which are old and inefficient. The reason that they're there is that's where oil comes into this country.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, the United States is going to be the major user of this oil, why not take the money that you're going to use to build a pipeline and build a new, efficient refinery in Canada and sell it right to the market?
How about it? We've got that question a lot online as well, Alex. Why not build your own refineries right there next to your tar sands? And if it's such a great thing for the U.S., then just send us the refined product when it's all ready to go.
Well, you know, first off, I think it's important to understand those refineries in the Gulf Coast. I would take some exception to a characterization of those refineries as old and inefficient. That is the largest refining center on the earth, and tens of billions of dollars have gone in to upgrading those facilities, and particularly to make those allow those facilities to process the kind of heavier crudes that you see from Alberta, from Mexico, and from Venezuela.
Still, why not do it in your own yard?
Because it would cost more money. It costs probably $10 billion to build an average size refinery. You already have those refineries. Those refineries are losing their traditional supply of crude from Venezuela and declining Mexican production. So it at the end of the day, it just results in a cheaper product rather than building an unnecessary refinery complex in Alberta. It is far, far cheaper at the end of the day to build a pipeline and move that oil down to where there is a demonstrated need and the capacity to process it without the unnecessary construction of tens of billions of dollars of infrastructure.
Randy Thompson, you're the rancher there, right in the path of this thing. How do you read what's going on now? Do you think this is coming? Do you think the Obama administration is going to green light it, or do you think opposition may stop it?
Well, I think it's a coin toss at this point in time. I think as the American people have actually found out the truth about this project and the fact that a lot of this oil, it will not be used domestically, or at least there is no guarantee at all that it will be used domestically. I think as the facts are uncovered, the opposition has grown, and I think the pressure is being turned up, so I think we have a chance at stopping this thing.
Randy Thompson, rancher whose 400 acres lies on the path of the proposed path of the Keystone XL pipeline. Thank you very much, Mr. Thompson, for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard in Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just called in with a comment. Earl Malmberg was a Sun Oil Company chemist who in 1967 had a breakthrough in making tar sands commercially viable, and that's when production started, commercial production, and he was involved in the partnership between Sun Oil and the Canadian government.
So he made it possible, and he was your father, I'm reading here, Richard.
He was my father.
So what do you think? The chemist who made it possible?
At University of Nebraska, ironically.
So should we do it or not?
We shouldn't do it.
Why?
You know, it's dirty oil. It's so full of asphaltenes that they have to grease up the pipes to get it through. It's, you know, and we don't, you know, I think it's laughable that we're talking about, well, we can't exhaust it for hundreds of years because we don't have hundreds of years. We're probably in the danger zone already, and we have to do heroic efforts to get off petroleum and into other sources of energy. I know it's going to be difficult. But, you know, our children and grandchildren depend on it.
Alex Probe, you know, there is that view. We heard it in Washington a lot in the streets in front of the White House last week, that looking at these tar sands and thinking about the pipeline, they look at the pipeline like a, you know, a heroin addict holding a new syringe, ready to plunge it in. And once you do, you're going to take it and take it and take it. And you hear our caller saying, it's too dirty. Don't do it.
Well, first off, let's put this back into perspective. The Canada represents 2% of global greenhouse gases. The oil sands represent 5% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions. The oil sands represent 0.1% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
But you want to expand. Isn't that the whole point?
Let's assume that the oil sands double. That's sort of an expectation that could occur over 15 years. We would represent 0.2% of the global greenhouse gas. And, you know, compare that to the U.S. coal fleet. Every day, the U.S. coal fleet produces 30 times the greenhouse gas emissions of the oil sands. So, you know, when we talk about the largest carbon bomb on the planet, I think it's very important that, and Michael made a great point earlier on, if we want to deal with greenhouse gas, the best way to deal with it is through consumption. 80 to 90% of the greenhouse gas from a barrel of oil doesn't come from the processing, it comes from the tailpipe of the vehicle. And if the U.S. is successful in turning off or reducing reliance on imported oil, the beauty of Keystone is it has been 100% built with private investor money, and the shippers and TransCanada are taking the risk that oil is needed. If oil isn't needed 20 years from now, that pipe will run empty, and it's to no loss to the American public. If it doesn't get built, that oil will very likely be lost to the U.S. for decades.
Susan Casey, we just got a minute. What do you say, coin toss or something else here, Susan?
Well, I'd like to go back to the last caller. He's absolutely right that this is really about a bigger issue. Tar sands is a type of oil that is now starting to be found all over the world. It's harder to access. It's dirtier. And what we're really at here is a crossroads. We're at a point where we can choose whether tar sands is our energy future or whether we want to go towards clean solutions. And the sort of real politic answer is that if we fill this pipeline with tar sands, if we keep going after tar sands, we're creating an incentive for big oil to be undermining our clean energy solutions. And that's what it really comes down to. You can't have both.
Michael Levy, which way do you read it? Which way do you think the White House will go?
I still think that ultimately they will approve this pipeline, but what I really want to hear is the rationale they give one way or the other, because this isn't the last decision like this that will have to happen. This is the first of many decisions where trade-offs will need to be made.
Boy, it sure is a big one, and it's right in front of us now. We will watch through the fall better informed for all of your contributions. Michael Levy, the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz at the Natural Resources Defense Council, thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Tom.
Alex Probe with the company that would build it, TransCanada, thank you, Mr. Probe.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.